So I really like this session because I think it nicely illustrates the value of CFP. There's a fairly clear direct link between low-level technical details. In fact, in the context of my talk here, it's so low-level, it's about dropping packets on the floor, and much higher-level concerns, regulatory concerns, business concerns, concerns about the user experience. So on packet loss, our interest in packet loss considerably ramped up with the FCC's open internet order. So let's take a look at a couple of the things that they said here. Before, providers were responsible for disclosing things about speed and latency. In the open internet order, they added packet loss as a necessary part of the network performance disclosure. So any of the ISPs in the United States now have to disclose something about packet loss. But they've left exactly what you have to disclose and where and how fairly unspecified at this point in time. What they have said is it has to be reasonably related to the performance of the consumer in a given geographic area in which they're purchasing service. And they gave a little bit of guidance here at the end. It should be measured in terms of average performance over a reasonable period of time and during periods of peak usage. So if you've been reading the Measuring Broadband America reports in the past that they've put out, this is fairly consistent with what they've done, large averages focusing in particular on peak times. There's something that's good for me personally. They said participation in the Measuring Broadband America program continues to be a safe harbor for at least the fixed broadband providers in meeting the requirement to disclose actual network performance. This is good for me because here at MIT, I think we've developed some real expertise in working with these data sets that they've been putting out. There's a couple caveats to the Measuring Broadband America that I want to briefly talk about here, in that it's primarily focused on measuring the access network itself. It's not dealing with interconnection. When I pointed this out to various people, people became a little bit disappointed and lost because they thought we were going to get to see loss metrics from the access providers about all of their interconnection and peering links, and that's perhaps not the path that that's going down. Though I would say that the Measuring Broadband America program as a whole is evolving, and there are some tests that are being introduced that will measure some of those interconnection paths. In particular, the paths with the video providers are being actively measured now with a given test in the Measuring Broadband America. So Dave briefly mentioned this. You might think, well, loss, who's actually paying attention to loss? It's a very low-level thing. In fact, it made it into some articles in Forbes. This was by a colleague, a friend of mine, actually, who initially, before the report was released, said, this one clause in the network neutrality regulations would be a fiasco for the internet, right? It's a big disaster. We can't do that because it would incentivize a problem that some of you probably have heard of buffer bloat. I think that's actually probably not true, and in fact, Nick walked this back a little bit. He said, wait, that scary network neutrality packet loss clause isn't that bad. But it's interesting, right? These metrics are being discussed outside the academic, outside the operational communities. So of course, actually, packet loss has been something that people have been talking about for a long time and how to measure it. I went back and pulled out some of the RFCs from the IETF that, in particular in the IPPM working group, that have been specifying different metrics for how to measure loss. So all the way back in 1999, probably further back than that as well. And we continue to talk about it. Matt Mathis's model-based performance metrics has loss measurements in there as well. So one takeaway from the IETF that's important, I think, is that most of those loss metrics that I just put up there were one-way loss metrics. That's important because loss on the internet really can be asymmetric. The bulk of the traffic flow often flows in one direction, so depending on which way you're measuring loss and how that aligns with the traffic flows, that can be really important. But I would say that that's not how most loss is being measured by regulators around the globe. I'm going to have some slides up on that in a second, so it's kind of just interesting. I want to talk about loss in the context of other metrics as well here. So loss has a relationship to the throughput that you're receiving. This is what's called the Mathis equation for TCP. It's a relatively simple model, but it's a fairly good model of the throughput a single TCP flow would achieve given a round trip time and maximum segment size, given the loss rate P that it has. So this assumes Reno, and there's some other assumptions built into this, but it's a fairly good model. So what you can do is you can plot out for a given loss rate and a given round trip time, what throughput a user is likely to achieve. So the reason I put that up, and the reason that that's important to understand, is because loss rate is not an independent variable. Loss rates swing to control congestion, and it depends on the behavior of TCP, which I would point out is not under the control of the ISP. So if you change how TCP is sending packets onto the wire, you're going to change the loss even for a fixed amount of capacity that you can push a flow through. So the other point here is that zero losses is not the right answer. TCP is critically dependent on getting that loss signal from the internet. So we don't want loss to be zero for flows that want to fill the pipe. TCP is probing, takes that loss, and responds to it and adapts its sending behavior. So how do we measure loss? What's the right answer? So this is now a separate question. I asked myself, a lot of the things from the IETF were about active probe-based ways of measuring loss. You can also get loss metrics itself from the routers. So there's an obvious question, how do those probe and router-based packet loss metrics compare? This is an interesting paper from Paul Warford out at Wisconsin that asked this question back in 2004, and I want to just put up one of his exhibits from that. The green and the red at the top are the losses that are recorded from active measurement tools, Ping and Zing, and the yellow at the bottom is what you read from the SNMP routers, the router itself. So this is there's two endpoints with the router somewhere in the middle, sending active probes between those endpoints. They're not ending up at the router like the congestion work was doing the previous session. It's going through the router, and then you're also looking at the loss metrics from the router itself. And you know, there's orders of magnitude difference between the two, which I think is really interesting. Turns out that it's actually even more interesting than that, though, because the green and the red loss episodes there don't turn out to align with the yellow. So if you assume that the yellow, what the router is saying is loss, is the correct answer, and is ground truth in some sense, which is what they did in the paper, and eliminate the green and the red episodes where they didn't coincide, you eliminate a whole lot of those active probe losses. The active probes still measure, even if the time periods align, much higher loss rates than the router seems to be recording. So here's a CDF of those losses with, on the far left, it's what the router records as the loss rates, and the active probe ones are on the right. So there's this real discrepancy. I don't actually know what the right answer is here. Some people assume that the router is telling the truth. I have shown this to others that say, no, in fact, I know for a fact, I have personal experience, that the routers don't always record loss, particularly historically speaking. Maybe that's not true now. This is a paper from 2004. Maybe that's out of date. But there's some differences there that I think are really interesting. So the FCC said that participation in Measuring Broadband America is a safe harbor. You don't need to do anything else. Participate there. We'll use one of the loss metrics that's reported from the tests that they run. They run all of these different tests. I've highlighted with arrows ones that directly report loss. The two at the top, the throughput ones, you can derive a loss metric from it given throughput in your model assumptions like I showed earlier in this talk. So which one should we derive loss from? I want to answer that question, what I did was I asked, how have other regulators around the globe looked at loss given the SAMNOS measurements, because lots of regulators are using the SAMNOS platform. What's interesting here is that the United States has never actually reported on loss, even though we've been collecting the data. The European Commission derives the loss metrics that it has reported on from the UDP latency tests. Singapore, again, also used UDP latency. The one that was in most of these report simple averages. Regulator that's interesting is the bottom one, Brazil, which they chose, they used the UDP latency test as well, but they chose to report their loss as the percentage of time that loss is below 2%. So that's interesting. Let me just show you a couple of these loss results. I'm not going to show you many. I have a lot more in another slide deck if you're curious. This is from the EU report. They had issued two of these reports in the reporting loss from 2012 and 2013. All of the loss here is, essentially all of the loss here is below 0.5%. so less than 0.5% of loss on any of the links that they're measuring. The loss in general got better in the between the times they issued those reports. So perhaps measuring this is impacting the behavior of providers. I liked this line. Even though the United States has never reported on loss, the EU looked at the raw data that the FCC makes available and compared the loss that they found in our data set to the loss that they had there. The part that I liked is US displayed significantly lower packet loss compared to Europe, but then they go on to say, in actuality, the difference is not significant and can be negligible with respect to the broadband performance for individual users. So I don't quite know if they think it's significant or not, but I thought that was sort of amusing. Across the EU, there were differences across the countries in terms of the loss rates. I think you would see likely the same thing in the United States, where some of the states, if they reported at the state level, would have some differences. Again, this is fiber to the home or fiber to the curb, some fairly different loss rates between the different countries. So what would we see if we looked at the data in the United States? The FCC has never reported on this in any of the reports that they issue, but the raw data is available. I chose to focus, most of these are on the UDP latency test. I'll show you one that's not. This is loss as measured by the UDP test. These are box plots, so 25th percentile median, 75th percentile is the box. The whisker is 1.5 times the intercordial range, and then plus signs are outliers past them. So this is for all of the providers that are currently in Measuring Broadband America. You can find the companies that you're interested in across the bottom. So Comcast is here, it's Time Warner. The satellite provider has the largest amount of variation and the highest loss, which is fairly predictable. I'm generating this, by the way, averaging across all of the users in the set, and I'm looking at the tests that are run to an off-net provider. So this is the one that I'm generating from a different test than the UDP latency test. This is a test that's called a latency under load test, where they send UDP packets at the same time that they're loading the channel with the throughput tests that they're running. So this is UDP loss during the upload test. So you're running an upload test, fully loading the channel, and then you're also sending UDP packets to see sort of what loss you can loss rates you see. What's interesting here is that the scale on the left, 100% loss is the top, 80% loss, 60% loss, 40% loss. So, you know, what's going on here? I don't know. Do I actually even believe these numbers? I think I should be fairly skeptical of them, actually, because you would have horrible throughput if you actually had a median number of, you know, 35% loss there for Verizon DSL. So this is a box plot. So this is the 25th percentile. The red line is the median, and the top of the box is the 75th percentile, and then the whiskers on it are the 1.5 times the interchordal range. So, you know, that's what the raw data shows. Maybe we should be a little bit skeptical of it, but I thought it was interesting anyways. In either of these, we're clearly averaging across a lot of time periods and a lot of users. So I wanted to dive into the data a little bit and look at the structure, both the temporal structure as well as the structure across the user population itself. So I chose to focus on one particular provider here that had a large number of users in the data set. This is the packet loss by hour for one of the providers. And during the 4 a.m., 5 a.m. hour, it's not perhaps terribly surprising that the loss rates are lower there, not significantly lower, but you do see some variation in structure there that I think is interesting. This is the average loss across the user population during that hour. If we then turn to look not at the average, but at the loss at the top 99.5 percentile, so pick essentially, I think this is the third worst hour in the user data set, what loss do you see during that for any of the users? And again, you can see here that, you know, 5 a.m. in the morning is the best time for the lowest chance of loss across the user population, and then it gets worse later in the day. So I am picking this is the worst users, right? So this, the average is here. What it is, I don't know. Yes. Yes, I don't know. I think that the reason I'm putting this up is that I think that the community and others are increasingly turning to understanding some of this tail behavior. And I do worry, absolutely, that this is not measuring something that's real about the network. It's
got to be
real. Well, I don't know what it is. And the natural inclination is to think that, you know, it is the access provider. It may or may not be. I really don't know here. I don't know what the ground truth is. So I was still averaging across users on those previous slides. Here, I'm now looking at the mean loss per user. So this is, for all of the users in the data set that I have, what's the average loss for that user? A whole lot of the users have fairly low, but then for the tail of the user population, something goes wacky with some of them. I don't know what. I should do more work to go understand what's happening in this tail here. But again, let me now not look at the mean, but look at the max loss in any hour by a user over the course of a month. So the users are now getting reordered in here. I'm not trying to maintain consistency, but so for any user, what's the max loss that they ever measured in a given hour over the course of a month? Now you see here, I think this is interesting because some small percentage of the users essentially never have any loss in any hour that they record, but a whole chunk of users actually have some amount of loss. Any time that you're past around here, I would say, you know, that's significant loss being measured by the user over that hour. This is the 98.5 percentile loss by user over the course of a month. So if I throw away the top 10 hours or so of loss, looking at that, you know, lots of the users are below 2%. But then even there's some tail behavior that is fairly bad for the users. I think that's interesting. Okay, so high-level conclusions. What I really want you to leave this talk with is a couple high-level bits sets. Loss rate due to congestion is not an independent variable. So this is not something that ISPs alone have responsibility for. They don't control several of the critical variables that are important to doing this. The right answer for loss rate is not zero either. I think that's critically important. So when the regulators put out their reports, we're not trying to drive this number down to zero. Some amount of loss is going to be in the system because of the behavior of TCP. Different measurement methods for loss may give very different results. So this gets back to the router versus probe-based ways of doing it. I think that there's a real need for additional research to understand why that is. Even with the active probe methods, we can have fairly different measures of loss. Again, I would like to know much better why that is. The loss under load metric is, you know, really a mystery to me. But at the end of the day, we do need some simple ways of talking about loss. The FCC, you know, requires that. The users need it. We have to be able to come to some consensus, both in the method, where we're going to measure, and how that's going to be reported. But now, this is where we concluded. What I was trying to show there is we're really not measuring a uniform distribution in any sense. This is a mixture of good and bad experiences. So how we report on that and how we talk about it, we have to be careful. What's the right way for looking at those results? So that's loss. Yes?
So just to refresh, you might have covered this in the very beginning. What method was being used in the SAM-NOS loss test? Is that trace route based or?
No. This is... the one I was reporting on here was the UDP packet loss one, and this is a fraction of UDP packets lost. It's UDP between the user's black box and a test server operated either on-net or off-net. The off-net ones that we've reported on in the past are two measurement lab servers. So you send over the course of an hour. It used to be with the data set that I was dealing with here, there was up to 600 packets sent per hour. They've turned up the number evidently to 2,000 packets sent over the course of the hour with some randomness between the packets to those test servers. Does that make sense?
It does.
Okay. Yes?
Do you know if they are allowed to run parallel experiments in the same room that they measure this?
That's a good question. Obviously, the UDP latency under load test is a parallel test, but that's the only one. The other ones are run sequentially. The other thing that's important with the FCC measurement methodology is that they, in general, defer if the user is loading the link. So if they detect that the user is sending some amount of traffic over some threshold, they will not run the test. So if you go look at the data sets, the number of probes that are actually sent during a given hour can be fairly different from 600 or 2,000. So when I'm reporting on an average for that hour, I didn't throw out data sets that perhaps had too few samples. That would be an obvious thing to do. You know, if we only tried to send 10 and we happened to lose all 10, does it actually mean that the hour had 100% packet loss? Perhaps not, right? Yep. There's lots of questions that they do. There's not sequential experiments running on theirs. Whether or not they're properly deferring when the user is running other sorts of traffic, I don't know. I have not studied that adequately. But yes, I think in general there's a lot of questions that would warrant additional investigation.
Yep. So what are your theories about why there's such a big difference between active measures and router-based measures?
Well, so actually the first thing I want to do is go understand whether or not that is still true. Is that an artifact for some reason of the experimental setup that Barford had? I don't know. They had a very high probing rate, for one thing. I don't know on that. My colleague that was arguing that routers miss things argues that routers are only configured to record losses at certain points in the code path, and if a buffer overflows somewhere else, they don't record it. And it gets dropped on the floor. Is that still his argument was, I know for a fact in a number of cases that this occurred. He had personal experience with it and was telling me the stories. Does that still occur? I don't know. Maybe the routers are better instrumented now. Yes.
But there's another phenomenon that's been documented, and I don't know how important it is here. When you're running TCP across a link, and the link is not, and the link is being fully pushed by the TCPs, so that you're triggering an occasional loss. There's a sort of a timing clock between the data packets going out, which get turned into ACKs, and the ACKs come back, which trigger into the data packet, and you actually can see, even in fairly large networks, you can see a stable pattern of queue exits and queue entrants. So you can see the queue running it, you know, full minus one, full minus one, full minus one. And if the queue is running in that state and you inject a packet at a random time into the pattern, the packet has a much higher probability of being dropped than it does than if it's injected as a result of this sort of self-clocking. This is particularly significant not just for probing but for SINs. And a phenomenon that's been found in certain circumstances is that a system full of steady-state TCP is particularly hostile to somebody trying to start a new connection because the probability that a SIN will get dropped is higher than the probability that a TCP will get a packet dropped as a congestion signal. Is that really going on today? I have some intuition that that's not, but that's another hypothesis on the table, that probing with UDP packets or pings or something like that under a system that's got a certain amount of load will consistently report a higher level of packet loss than a steady state TCP. There's an entirely different way of measuring loss. If you take these TCP transfers, the download test and the upload test that Sam knows is doing, they go at a certain speed, and either that speed is clamped by the speed of your access link, in which case the drops will be occurring at your access link to throttle the thing, or if you were to rate limit the TCP so that your access link was not the limit, you would then see whether a standing TCP ever got drops. And for some of the servers, the MLAB servers in particular, they keep count of the number of loss events. So one way you might measure the behavior of the system is, instead of probing it like this, you might look at loss or congestion event signals as a side effect of an ongoing TCP. And that would tell you, at least by one argument, the experience that a real TCP was having. But the important point here is, if you go back to that graph that Steve had earlier, and you say, well, loss rates of 0.5%, something like that, is that bad? Maybe we should just say that's low enough it doesn't count, because maybe these numbers are not really statistically significant to more than about, you know, a binary order of magnitude. But the numbers are too big to sustain high throughputs. And there's an interesting question. Why are those drops occurring if the probe defers when the link's being used? Why is the number anything but zero? Is it really residual congestion inside the network? Is it something related to the technology? Maybe these are actually just noise in the outside plant. I don't know. The idea that there's certain users who for an hour had 100% losses, you know, part of my intuition says, well, maybe you should go clean them up, because maybe there's something wrong with that particular piece of the outside plant. But there's a tremendous amount that we don't know here that just begins to show through in this data. And obviously what worries me is, if you just take these numbers and without any data cleaning, you average them, the difference between one provider and another is probably a result of stuff which is not statistically significant, but people will compare these numbers if you're not careful. But you can't just set a threshold and say, well, below this we don't care, unless the threshold is low enough that for the TCP equation, the transfer rates you're actually aspiring to are achievable, and it's too high now. So this is there's some real complexity in here about how these measurements should be done and whether these are measuring the right things and so forth. So we can have a more general conversation about how we should be reporting things. For example, I think with respect to the question of congestion and interconnection links, I think there's a very interesting question. How do you explain, what's the best way to explain which links were congested and how? I think that one of the things, this is a question for George. Many of your probes cross the same interconnection link. So you started out with 1 million pairs, and then you ended up with, I think it was 3,000 links on which. Have you already identified all the probes that are going across the same link and reduce that to one sample?
Well, we haven't done this. So you want all the pairs that they see the same interconnection? Is this correct?
Well, does that mean, what I'm saying is, you said you found 3,000 links. Is that 3,000 distinct links, or is that 3,000 probes where there was a congested link?
No, because those are 3,000 links, not probes.
It's 3,000 distinct links.
Yeah.
Out of how many?
Well, if you take all the different segments, we're talking about hundreds of thousands.
Say it again?
We're talking about hundreds of thousands. Because when you have a trace route, every segment, it's a link, right?
Right, but that's 100,000. Is that 100,000 of the trace routes in which you found a congested link?
No, from different trace routes that have a different path, you may end up with the same link.
Yes.
That's the problem. So I don't have the numbers now, but we're talking in total. You examine a few hundred thousands individual segments, and from this you end up with 3,000 of them, or maybe a little more, that are actually have a significant signal of congestion.
So that was a percentage, not we were sending an email back and forth around, you know, this one of the things is scoping the problem of congestion and how, you know, when you generally when you're looking at the internet, you're looking at congestion, you gotta scope the internet. Because, you know, we could say, well, there's congestion over there on that road, saying all ways into Boston are horrible, right? And the other question, you know, kind of coming into the discussion with Steve, you know, one of the things about measuring Broadband America, and I think gets into controversy before data is published, is the quality of the MLabs infrastructure. And that always comes into question, because MLabs carefully publishes what they want to publish, and it's, you know, looking at that as a true measure of Broadband America, that does come into question a lot of how unbiased that infrastructure is. Has anybody looked at taking the SAM-NOS probes and fully meshing them and saying you can actually get a better view of the interconnect by removing like the MLabs component to it?
No, and by design.
Okay.
Because Measuring Broadband America was designed to measure the access link and not the interconnection. They, other than video, which has only been recently added, even there, it's sort of carefully designed to just measure that. So it's not looking at the interconnect. And there's been, I think, some hesitancy both in the FCC's part as well as the provider's part to extend that project to measuring interconnection at this point in time. That may change going forward, though.
But the MLabs keeps coming back and forth. And if the goal is to measure access, MLabs doesn't measure access.
Well, the FCC does not report on any time periods when the interconnection between the access provider and measurement lab is congested. That has occurred, and they have excluded those weeks or month. When that congestion has occurred. So the assumption is always that it's a clear path between the edge of the access provider and measurement lab's infrastructure. The reason that the off-net servers were preferred is because there was a concern, particularly at the beginning of the project, that if the tests to the on-net servers were utilized, that the access providers would muck with the results, use the fact that they could easily identify the users, even though it's easy to identify them either way, but there was a concern about the legitimacy of the tests if they were the test servers were owned and operated by the access providers. So that was why the off-net servers were the preferred servers to report on. But it had to be a clear path.
So we're going to take a break. Well, go ahead, Arthur.
So I have a question for the people in the room who are clueful on routers. One of the results George pointed to on the congestion was the magnitude of the congestion. So this would be the magnitude of the change in the daily round trip times. And we were seeing in the US it was about 25 milliseconds. And in other cases it could be higher, 50 milliseconds, 60 milliseconds. Now, the question we have, and we canonically are saying this is happening in a router, in a queue. We have no idea whether this is FIFO queuing. And a particular piece we don't know is, are we seeing something that user data would experience, again, because we're using ICMP probes. So the question I have for people who are knowledgeable about routers, could user data see delays of that magnitude when a router is congested? And to what extent do you think ICMP packets are experiencing what user data would experience?
I think I need to understand the testing a little bit more, but you can definitely see an increase in ICMP just from the prioritization elements around ICMP returns. And I don't know if you factored that into it. I mean, that's...
Well, we factored it in only to make the statement that if the ICMP is getting delayed to be turned around by the router, is that is reflective of some stress on the router, some higher load. Is that... Is that a true statement?
It is a true statement, but it's on the processor, not on the packets. So the whole prioritization of ICMP, a router will delay or drop an ICMP packet at its processing without having any impact to the user. That's kind of the general problem with trace routes in general, and that's why when you do the analysis, you say the latency continues after that particular router, the stops at that router. We spend tons of time just talking to explain to users how trace route works, because when someone runs clean water or something, they see a spike and they go, they pack lots of that router. Like, no, there's like ICMP prioritization happening.
Yes. No. If the latency or loss continues, then yes, that should be an indication that anything going through that router from a consumer standpoint is probably experiencing. And Tony, correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think it is a indication that there is something from that point on. And I think that's one of the analysis that Kata did that I think you guys were looking at. So that's a good indicator.
The first piece, just separate from our study, if there was congestion in a router, could user data be experiencing delays on the order of 25 milliseconds? Does that sound reasonable, plausible, within the U.S.?
New incremental delays.
I don't know what the queue depths are. I think it's possible. So you're talking about delays and not drops, like where it's...
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's queued. You know, I'm not sure. I think it's possible. I mean, I think some of the buffers are quite large, like, you know, potentially, you know, if not configured otherwise, okay. You know, maybe on the order of more than a second, okay. Which is, you know, leads to a question of, is that smart?
So I'm going to take a break. Let me explain the afternoon. We have two more talks on measurement, then we have a couple of talks on future directions. We have a little wrap-up, but we cannot be late because we have to leave the room. There's another event coming in here. So if you look at the schedule, you'll see that at 4:15 it says adjourn. We can't slip. We have to be out. So we're going to invite you all down to Andy's area on the third floor. We're going to invite you down to Andy's area on the third floor so we can empty this room. But the point is we have to leave on time. That's the one thing that is a gating function. And I don't want to amputate the very end of the meeting, but we will if we have to. So we need to sort of stay on schedule here. So a break until 2:30 or, yeah, say 2:32.
What's the password here? Is there one?
I don't know.
Oh, okay. No, there is one.